Today is a work session regarding a grant application for the Oregon Judicial Department, but we will get to that when we have a quorum so that we can work it. In the absence of that quorum, we will begin a public hearing on House Bill 5012 relating to the financial administration of the Oregon Dispute Resolution Commission. So we'll open that public hearing, and Robin Lamont.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. You have in front of you a handout that looks like this from me to the Public Safety Subcommittee. What I'd like to do is very briefly walk you through that. A couple of things to set the context. First of all, there were budget notes from the 1999 session. Actually, they were comments within their budget that instructed the agency to continue their work and do more outreach efforts to increase awareness of the dispute resolution program to state agencies and the public. The commission was requested at the next budget hearing to bring documentation on the number and types of cases encountered in the public policy program, how the cases were resolved, the timelines of the cases from inception to resolution, and the estimated savings of mediating the cases versus having them resolved by litigation. The 1999 legislature also asked the agency to continue to look at shifting the remaining general fund expenditures to other funds as was requested by the 1997 legislature. Moving on, there is a PowerPoint presentation that I'd like to briefly walk you through. It looks like this.
Right here. Should be this memo.
Oh, okay.
Second page of the memo dated February 16.
Lots of paper.
Lots of paper. There we go.
Okay.
There are three components to statewide dispute resolution. There's the Oregon Dispute Resolution Commission that provides training, assistance, and support to state, court, and local programs. There are community dispute resolution programs that receive funding through the commission. And there is the Public Policy Dispute Resolution Program that's coordinated by the Governor's Dispute Resolution Steering Committee and receives funding and assistance through the commission. We're going to spend quite a bit of time talking about the public policy dispute resolution piece of this budget for a couple of reasons. One is that the filing fee surcharge that supports both the commission and these programs is insufficient to support all of the staff that are associated with public policy dispute resolution. The Department of Administrative Services asked for an increase in the general fund support for the program of about $281,000, and the General Government Subcommittee did not fund that. Therefore, there's a shortfall in the funding that's available, and we also have the issue of the legislature repeatedly requesting that general fund support be phased out for that program. So you will have a big section discussing that. In the meantime, and to start off with, we will talk about what the Dispute Resolution Commission itself does. The Dispute Resolution Commission administers three programs. As I noted, the Community Dispute Resolution Program. There is a court system appropriate dispute resolution program that encourages the development and use of alternative means of civil dispute resolution. And then there is, as I noted, the public policy dispute resolution component. When you look at the commission's budget, you will see that a significant portion of it is special payments, which are the pass-through of $1.25 million in filing fee surcharge that is distributed to the 27 community dispute resolution centers. And in addition to that, the operating budget uses $633,000 from the civil filing fee surcharge. $119,284 in general fund for the public policy dispute resolution piece, and funding out of the beginning balance of $52,902. The beginning balance is also an issue that the commission will be speaking to. The statutes authorize them to reserve a portion of the 50% of the surcharge that goes to community dispute resolution centers for new centers and also for other costs within the agency. And I think with that, I will turn this over to the agency and to DAS, unless there are any questions on what I have just gone through.
Any questions from the members? If not, we'll proceed.
Chair Miller and members of the committee, my name is Susan Brody. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Dispute Resolution Commission. As Robin has mentioned this morning, we'll be presenting our budget in two parts. I'm first going to cover the main portions of our budget, and then when I'm completed with that, we will cover in more detail the public policy dispute resolution program budget. And the reason for that is that we are a participant in the public policy dispute resolution program, but not the sole agency that's involved. That's a collaborative effort with the Department of Administrative Services, the Department of Justice, our agency, and the governor's office by statute. And so when I get to that part of the presentation, I'll be joined by representative of the governor's office and from Department of Justice to talk more about that. It's governed in part by a steering committee. So I'll begin by talking about the bulk of the Dispute Resolution Commission budget. And I have provided some slides in a handout in a PowerPoint format, which I think you have in front of you. The commission's work in the area of dispute resolution is governed by ORS 36. We have a mission, which is to support the beneficial and effective use of conciliation, negotiation, mediation, and other collaborative problem-solving processes. We're overseen by a 7-member commission, which is appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate. And we're charged with the establishment of a comprehensive policy and process for the establishment of state-funded dispute resolution programs. In your handout, you'll see that we have identified 7 key goals for our program. They include developing the capacity of Oregonians to resolve disputes early and effectively, to continue support for community dispute resolution programs throughout the state, to develop an integrated and coordinated program that helps state agencies with public disputes that they encounter, and through education, support, and evaluation, promote the sustainability of state-funded dispute resolution programs and to integrate programs across state and local government.
Susan, can I interrupt you for just a second? I want to recess the public hearing on House Bill 5012, and we were awaiting a quorum to arrive so that we could consider approving a submission to the U.S. Department of Justice, the Drug Courts Program Office, Drug Court Grant Applications. The recommendation is that we approve this request. You all, I think, have this paper entitled Oregon Judicial Department, dated February 19. So simply our consideration is whether or not to approve this request for this grant application.
And are we in work session?
We are in a work session.
Mr. Chair, I would move approval of the submission of the U.S. Department of Justice Drug Courts Program Office Drug Court Application.
Thank you, Representative Leonard. Is there a discussion of the motion? Is there objection? Hearing and seeing none, it is so ordered. Thank you. Go back and heat the Department of Justice. And, Now we'll reconvene the works or the public hearing on House Bill 5012. Thank you, Susan. I appreciate that.
You're welcome. We have a small staff of 4 full-time equivalent employees. Again, in your handout, there's a staff organization chart that shows how we're organized. We have 2 part-time positions that work primarily in the community dispute resolution area, a full-time executive assistant, myself as director, and then a dispute resolution program administrator that spends time both in the community and the public policy parts of the program. Next slide, sheet number 5, shows our primary program areas that Robin mentioned. Community dispute resolution program work is the bulk of the work that we do, but we also play a key role in the public policy dispute resolution program, working with state agencies, and then also do work with the courts, which we call our court-referred mediation work. The flow of funds chart, which is page 6 of your handout, is just to provide you with an overview of how funding flows through our agency. We receive funding both from a surcharge on court filing fees and also a small general fund amount. ODRC, or Dispute Resolution Program Services, receive $120,000, or proposed for the next biennium, $120,000 in general fund, and funds from the surcharge on court filing fees. But those funds from the court filing fee surcharge, 50%, as Robin mentioned, flow through us and then to grants to community dispute resolution centers throughout the state. 20% of the surcharge is passed to the Department of Administrative Services for use in the public policy dispute resolution program. So that's what this chart depicts. I want to just briefly summarize our program in this overview section, and then I'll get into more detail later. Some of you may not know what a community dispute resolution program or a community dispute resolution center is. It can be a nonprofit agency, or it can be part of city or county government. It delivers dispute resolution services like mediation to the local community. It operates primarily with the use of trained volunteer mediators and small staffs. And each of these community dispute resolution centers is required to have an advisory board that represents a cross-section of the community. The Dispute Resolution Commission staff at the state level provides the following services. We provide technical assistance to these community programs and help maintain this network of accessible and high-quality centers. We work with counties and local groups to get new programs started at the local level. We administer a grant program that provides the essential funding for these programs, and we establish minimum qualifications and training requirements for the volunteers and staff who practice in these programs. Our work with the court system overlaps to some extent with our work with the community programs, because part of what we're trying to do is to provide linkages between these community programs and the circuit courts, so that the circuit courts can take advantage of the services that are provided in the community programs, and also so that the work of the community programs prevents certain cases from actually going to the courts, where issues can actually be resolved without a court filing. Our primary responsibilities in working on the court program is to coordinate with the Oregon Judicial Department to provide information and education to citizens and to the legal community about the benefits and opportunities for mediation, to create these linkages that I was talking about between community programs and the courts, and again to set training and qualification requirements, this time for mediators who operate in the circuit court environment. Our third program area is the Public Policy Dispute Resolution Program, which, as I mentioned, is a coordinated effort under ORS 183-502 that involves the Department of Justice, Department of Administrative Services, and the Governor's Office, and we'll be talking more about that later. We have 4 primary initiatives that we've proposed for the next biennium. Our first one is to work with community dispute resolution programs to improve program services and to increase the resources available to them. And in partnership, a second, is in partnership with these community programs to try to support development of school conflict resolution education. We also have as an initiative to enhance outreach and public education programs so that people understand better what's available to them and how to utilize those services, and then to build the capacity and effectiveness of the public policy program. Some of the major program changes in the last 10 years, the 1997 Legislative Assembly increased the dispute resolution surcharge and changed the allocation to its current allocation, that is the 50% to community centers, 30% to the commission, and 20% to the public policy dispute resolution program. We've also had a major increase in the number of community programs that are operating in the state. So in the last 5 years, we've gone from 15 community programs to 27, and we're real proud of that. We've increased the number of CDRCs that are providing mediation services in the Manufactured Dwelling Park program, which is run by the Department of Housing and Community Services. The community programs that we help to fund provide some of the mediation services under contract with the Department of Housing and Community Services for mediating a range of disputes that can come up in that setting. And then we've also had a significant increase in the number of state agencies who are using alternative dispute resolution. I'll be talking in more detail later about the benchmarks that we tie to. We link to about 7 state benchmarks. In addition, we oversee an extensive data collection effort that tracks workload measures and some outcomes for the community dispute resolution programs. And we're planning to work with community programs in the next biennium to improve outcome measurement. In this biennium, our agency contracted with an economist and program evaluation consultant to assist in the development of outcome measures and survey instruments for the public policy dispute resolution program, in part to respond to the legislative charge we received when our budget came before the previous Legislative Assembly. The outcome measures are complete, and we're just beginning a pilot testing of the instruments that will be completed this summer, and that pilot will be completed this summer. We coordinate with many other state agencies, with the Oregon Judicial Department, as I mentioned. We've been active in participating in their future of the courts work, and we have a member of the judiciary who sits with us as an ex officio member of our commission so that we have good linkages with the court system. We have the coordination with Department of Justice, DAS, and the Governor's Office on the Public Policy Program. We work with the Department of Education to encourage conflict resolution education in the schools. There's the work we do with the Department of Housing and Community Services on the Manufactured Dwelling Park Program. And then we also coordinate with the Oregon Mediation Association and the Oregon State Bar on outreach, citizen education, and training for mediators. On the technology side, we have a web page which we use extensively and provides information to citizens, interested organizations, and state agencies. We produce newsletters, handbooks, and other documents and provide those online as well as paper copies of them. We have a statistical reporting system for our community programs, which is also a computer-based system, which has provided for efficiencies in both for the community programs and for us in collecting and reporting data. And again, in this biennium, we've worked with the Department of Justice to develop a state agency ADR database so that we have better data and information on the kinds of alternative dispute resolution efforts that are going on across state government. We have no budget-related policy legislation this session, and our affirmative action report can be found on pages 66 and 67 of our budget book, which I believe you all have in front of you as well. So that's the overview.
Are there any questions at this point?
Chair, I
Robin?
Mr. Chair, members, I was just curious on your program activity report. A couple of pieces of information I wasn't clear about. One is the difference between total cases and total cases receiving mediation services or actual mediation.
And, you know, maybe I can address that a little bit later, too, but just in brief. Cases go through a screening process. Someone calls up the Community Dispute Resolution Center, and they have a conflict or a dispute, and they may, what they may need is just information and referral to another source, or the screening shows that this really isn't something that needs to move forward. And so that's why you have a fewer number of cases that have the mediation services or actual mediations. And that's a really important function because you don't want to do mediate, you don't want to provide mediation to cases that really aren't ready for that. But there may be other help that you can provide to steer them in the right direction.
One question that you likely cover this too, or maybe you won't, but as I see the list on page 7 of this handout, the dispute resolution centers, is the funding for those centers, it is not exclusively through the state, is it?
That, Chair Miller, that's correct.
Are they precluded from raising money from their local communities, from the counties, from citizens who care to contribute to nonprofit organizations?
Not at all. In fact, we encourage that. And in the grants that we award, we have matching requirements for those state grants. And so over time, they're to have a higher and higher amount of funds that they contribute that come from these local sources or from other it could be from other grants, it could be from federal grants, from other state grants, it could be from raising money in the local community.
Okay.
I'll move forward then to provide a more detailed discussion of our programs and services. As has been mentioned, we are organized really into one budget unit. We have the dispute resolution program services provided by our staff in the three areas mentioned, and then we have the grants that we provide to community programs. For the community dispute resolution part of our budget, our statutory authority comes from ORS 36-100 through 245. We are charged with providing grants to community programs and in overseeing their work. Our primary purpose in this program is to develop and maintain community dispute resolution services throughout the state. Our basic functions are to work with counties and local groups to start programs in unserved counties. An example of that is in this biennium, new programs have started in Klamath County and also in Clatsop County. There are 27 community programs now operating throughout the state in 21 counties. We administer the grant program, we do data collection and monitoring, we establish minimum qualification and training requirements, we provide information and technical assistance to centers through a variety of methods, in meetings, on the phone, through newsletters. We help sponsor training, we produce handbooks and manuals and so forth, and we facilitate partnerships between the community dispute resolution centers, court programs, and with conflict resolution programs in the schools. I've included, we've just been referencing...
Excuse me, Susan, Senator Crow has a question.
Yeah, as you oversee these community dispute resolution centers, are you pleased with what you're seeing? Are these, for the most part, very effective and doing their job? And are they cost effective?
I think so. We're very pleased. There's wonderful dedication of the people who are involved with these programs. As I mentioned, they couldn't really operate without the volunteer hours that are put in by community representatives in those areas. They work very hard. Some of them struggle because their funding base is not large, but the staff that serve these centers are dedicated, they're knowledgeable, they're skilled, they work many more hours than they receive compensation for, and we feel very good about the network that we're helping to provide. Doesn't mean that there isn't a need for more resources and for training and support for these programs, but we're quite happy with the quality of the service that's being provided.
Are you seeing disputes being resolved?
We are. We are. And if you look at the page 8 of the handouts that Robin was referring to, you'll see the number of clients that are served by these programs, the total number of cases that are handled, which has been going up, resolution rate for cases that come before these community programs, as you can see for the last 4 periods, hovers around 80%. So yes, absolutely they are. And they're being resolved in a number of different areas. They can range from the kinds of disputes that come before these community programs can be neighbor-to-neighbor disputes. There's an issue about a fence height, or there's an issue about a barking dog, or a car that's been abandoned and in the neighborhood. It could be something that would rise to a code violation at the local level if it wasn't resolved neighbor to neighbor through these programs. It also often involves family issues too, so working with family and youth to resolve issues that come up in a family setting, or work that we provide with the juvenile justice system. So there's a whole range of disputes that are taken on.
Is it diverting cases from the courts perhaps and saving a lot of money that way?
Yes.
Got a question over there, Senator.
I'm sorry, Representative Canope.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I noticed on your slide here that your cases are rising dramatically, and the success rate or the resolution rate is going down slightly. Is that because the cases are getting harder, or there's just more of them, so it's harder to spend the time to get the resolution?
I would want to see statistics over a longer period of time to, I'd like to see statistics over a longer period of time to note that the resolution rate is actually going down. I don't think you can read too much into this for 1 year that it's at 75% as opposed to you had 80% in 96, 97, 79, and 98, 99. So I don't think there's a trend here. If that continued over a period of time, it might be something that we'd want to look at. Sometimes the actual resolution of the case is not the most critical thing as well. Getting people together in a room to talk and understand each other's point of view can sometimes yield as much as having a formal mediated agreement. We've identified in the handouts on page 10 and 11, on pages 9 and 10, 5 of the benchmarks that we are linked to. And I could answer questions about that if you like, but it has to do with benchmarks relating to volunteerism in the community and feeling part of the community, as well as we've identified 3 of the benchmarks in relating to juvenile crime that we believe our programs are linked to. A large percentage of the mediations that our community programs do are in the area of juvenile victim offender mediation. And so that links directly to these benchmarks on juvenile crime and juvenile arrests. A key outcome that we've identified for the community program is to have increased access by citizens throughout Oregon to community dispute resolution services. I mentioned that we currently have programs in 21 counties. Our target is to have to increase this by 4 over the next biennium so that we would have programs in 25 counties. One issue that faces us is that some of the more rural counties don't have as much resource to work with because the surcharge on court filing fees doesn't generate as much money in those more rural areas of the state. So one of the things we're interested in working on are regional approaches to the delivery of community dispute resolution centers services so that several counties might work together. That's happening right now with Deschutes, Crook, and Jefferson counties. And we've been working recently with some of the counties in Eastern Oregon and with Eastern Oregon University to see if there might be some opportunities there for their to partner with each other and thereby leveraging resources from the different entities out there. A critical factor that affects services and community programs is the need to respond to changing demographics. We find a need, we've identified a need to assist community centers to enhance their cultural and language competencies so they can be more effective in serving the growing diversity of the population. And in these rural counties with low surcharge collections, what I just mentioned, building these partnerships so that they can build programs even though the resources available to any one county are small. On the court side, our basic functions are training and education, setting training and education requirement for mediators in circuit courts, working with the judicial department to encourage mediation in civil disputes, and especially educating citizens and members of the legal community about the opportunities. A key outcome that we've identified for this area is to increase the involvement of community programs in small claims mediation. And we currently have 8 of our community programs who are doing this work in partnership with the courts, and we have as a target to increase this to 10 of our community programs working in the small claims area in the next biennium. In your handout on page 11 and 12, I've listed what we consider to be some of the key accomplishments of both our community and court program areas. We've increased the number of community dispute resolution centers operating in the state. We've implemented this computerized data tracking system. We've completed a school conflict resolution information project with the Department of Education. In the last session, we received $15,000 from the Department of Education to produce a handbook for schools on how to implement conflict resolution education. We did that. We were very successful. It's been distributed to school districts throughout the state. It's on our webpage. We've held workshops, and we're getting very, very good feedback on that effort. We obtained grant funds and initiated an evaluation of juvenile victim offender mediation programs in the state. One of our jobs is to do evaluation of mediation programs, and so this is something that will help us understand what's working well and what's not working for some of the programs that are offering that service and how it might be provided in more counties throughout the state. We've improved grant program administration. We've implemented new financial accountability reporting provisions for community programs. We've worked with judicial staff and citizens in Eastern Oregon, as I mentioned. We co-sponsored a restorative justice conference that focused on techniques and programs to address the needs of victims and communities in dealing with crime issues. And I would point out that in our statutory charge, we have an item that asks us to find alternative methods, to work on finding alternative methods for addressing needs of crime victims. So this is in line with that statutory charge. We've made it easier to for citizens to get information from us through our in-state toll-free number. And I won't go over all of these, but you can see them here on the list. In the grants to community dispute resolution centers, part of our program, I'd like to focus for just a moment on that. Our grants are a key factor in the success of those programs. As was mentioned, we encourage those programs to also match those funds from other, in fact, they're required to match those funds from other sources, and we work with them to try to build more community support and obtain resources within their community. 50% of the surcharge is dedicated for use by those community programs. In the current biennium, over $900,000 was distributed to these community programs. In the 2001-2003 biennium, it would be a little over $1 million that we would be distributed for existing community programs. In addition, we hold as a reserve funds that are collected from the surcharge on court filing fees in each individual county. We hold those in reserve if the county does not have a program yet, so that when folks in that county are ready to start a program, there's some money there that can be used for startup purposes. So Clatsop County is an example of that. It wasn't until this year that they were ready to start a community program there. They organized a really extensive effort, surveyed members of the community, brought together key players, put a plan together, and came to the commission and said, we're ready to start a program. We could then draw on the funds that had accumulated over the years that had been collected for that purpose and use that as a startup grant to the Clatsop Community Program to get them going. And then now they will go into our regular grant cycle.
Help me with my understanding. When I asked you the question of the list on page 7 of the dispute resolution centers, at least I intended to ask whether or not these were exclusively state funded. Am I hearing now that it's a match and that every one of these listed on page 7 is a 50% contribution from the state and 50% from more local sources or grants or some combination?
Chair Miller, the community programs, let me try this again because I don't think I explained it very well before. The community programs receive a combination of funds from the state through our program and other sources of funds. And over a period of 5 years, they have to increase the amount that they're putting up as a match. So by the end of that 5-year period, it is
100%.
100%, well, 50%.
100% match?
100% match.
Okay. With respect to the example you gave in Clatsop County where you said they're collecting money so that they can get enough to do a startup, during the time they've been holding this money with the collections from the filing fees, should I assume that that is all segregated and that none of those filing fees are used for any other program, any other county, just all reserved for Clatsop?
That's correct. That's how our commission has been treating those dollars.
Must by statute, or that's just
what we're required to do is after funds have been collected for a period of 3 years, if they have not been used by a center in a county, they can be used for broader purposes. But our commission has made the policy decision that they would hold those funds for use by a center starting up in a county so that they're available for use within that county.
Would I be right in assuming that if a county decided that this was something they really wanted to get into, that they aren't limited to contributing whatever funds they can raise in a county, something other than the filing fees, they could fund this program, couldn't they?
Yes, absolutely. They could. Counties could, centers within counties could start programs without any funds from the Oregon Dispute Resolution Commission if they wanted to, and we actually do have a couple examples of that where there are centers operating that don't receive funds from the program.
Okay, that's helpful. Thank you. Senator Trow?
I was just going to ask, maybe for Clackamas, could you give us some idea of how much the grant is and then what they use the grant for in Clackamas County?
In
Clatsop.
Clatsop. I'm sorry. Okay, Clatsop.
The new one?
Yeah, Clatsop.
I don't, the amount of the Clatsop grant.
Oh, if that's difficult to get at, I'm sorry.
Well, actually, if I total. The amounts that the different programs receive vary quite a lot by county. And in the case of Clatsop, the startup money that we just gave to them to begin their program, I'm sorry, I'm not going to be able to read this. It looks like it was a little over $17,000 that was made available to begin their startup of their program. I could provide you with more details.
Just was trying to visualize a little bit better how it worked.
Yeah, none of the amounts are very large, really. And that's part of the challenge that community programs have is, if you think about the fact that we're in this biennium, we're distributing a little over $900,000 to 27 different programs. You can see that none of them really receive a really large amount from this source, and they have to supplement it from other sources to have an effective program.
They rely a lot on volunteers, you said. The volunteer mediators, do they get paid anything?
They don't, and that's really one of the it can be both a struggle for the programs. Occasionally they can charge for some services and do, but it's if you think about it, with this relatively small investment of state funds, what happens is that you leverage all of this person power through the use of the volunteers in centers across the state. So it's really a very positive benefit in terms of the investment that the state makes in money, what we get back from it. I'll continue. We've had a significant increase in the number of centers receiving grants. More than 10 centers have started in the last 4 years. And I think that's, I've really covered the other points that I had to make responding to the questions that you had, and the statistical activity report is provided in the list of centers by counties, and we have other information about the work that the community programs do, and I'd be happy to provide that if you find that would be useful. I think that really completes my detailed presentation on our program services, aside from the public policy dispute resolution program, which we'll be dealing with later. Proposing to continue 4 full-time equivalent positions in the next biennium. You may have noticed that we have 4.4 FTE that are showing up this biennium. That's because we had a limited duration, 0.4 of a position we've used this biennium that we were able to do because we received outside grant sources to fund this evaluation of victim offender mediation programs. So 0.4 of a position has been managing that evaluation project. That evaluation project will conclude at the end of the biennium, and so that 0.4 position will go away.
Questions?
Senator Trow.
I think in the overview, we heard that you depend upon the filing fee for a substantial amount of your funding, general fund, the other part. Is the filing fee your share of that, or do you get, I don't know how that works, but do you get enough of that so that there's money for this program? Are there other claims to the filing fee that compete with yours?
The dispute resolution surcharge on court filing fees, which is the one we draw on, gives 30% of those revenues to the commission for the purposes of running the program. 50% to the community programs, and then 20% through DAS. So the 30% of the surcharge that comes directly to us is what funds our staff positions, except for that small amount of general fund that we also receive.
Robin, I think, mentioned that there's some problem with the ending balance or something, did you say?
I mentioned, Mr. Chair, Senator Trow, I mentioned the fact that their budget assumes the use of some of the beginning balance for their operations.
Okay.
And they will need to get into that as they get into their discussion of their detailed budget numbers.
Okay. So you're going to have that discussion later?
Yeah, we do. proposed, we will need to use $52,000 of our beginning fund balance to help pay for the costs of delivery of our program services. And I think in response to your question, in the longer term, it may be that in order to sustain the level of service that we provide, that it will be necessary to look at supplementing the sources of money or the amounts of money that come into our program in the next legislative session. We've proposed a budget here that will provide what we need, we believe, for the next biennium. As we come to the 2003 legislative session, we may need to be looking at either an increase to the surcharge or some other mechanism to bring some additional money in to be able to sustain services.
Representative Doyle.
Thank you. It's a good lead-in, I guess, for my question. I guess my understanding is even though the filing fee surcharge, you know, helps support the cost of particularly the local centers, it's not just those who file court actions that use these centers for dispute resolution. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And to follow up, is there any mechanism, I guess, to charge those who are not using the, who don't go through the court system for these services?
When Chair Miller and Representative Doyle, the thinking behind this is that when community programs take on cases prior to them being filed in court, that there's a benefit to the court system because it keeps cases from going to the court, so that it makes sense to support the program delivery of services through the filing fees that are collected by the court. Right now, those community program services are primarily offered without charge. I think in some limited instances, a few of the programs have sliding scales and occasionally will charge, but for the most part, they don't. Don't know if that answers your question.
Well, I guess it. I'm curious about the policy issue. It certainly when you've got those either with low income or that the intent is to try to resolve the issue as quickly as possible, you know, under these alternative circumstances, that it might make sense to do that. But if you're getting into, you know, what might be generally financial issues that are trying to be resolved before they go to court, then I guess it would also make sense to me that those people should be paying for the service, and it's not just a mechanism to keep them out of court as it is, you know, here's a service to help them resolve an issue that if they didn't, they'd be going to court anyway. So I don't know if there's a way to identify the type of dispute that could then, you know, determine whether there should be a fee paid or not. But I would be concerned that, as you're saying, there might be a need for additional funds
in the future,
then, you know, why aren't we looking at that as an alternative source of funds?
Chair Miller and Representative Doyle, in fact, our commission has just organized a committee to look generally at the future of community programs. So we're trying to step back and say, okay, what does the future hold for these community programs? How are they currently funded? Are there alternative ways that we should be looking? Are there alternative things we should be looking at to ensure their financial health into the future and the continuation of the services they provide? And sort of a strategic planning exercise that the commission is just embarking on. And we're starting that now because we want to be well prepared for the next legislative session to see whether there are some alternatives to examine, and that when we come back to the legislature next time, we can have done that work and really scoped out a variety of options. So I hope that will help.
Just so I understand, if I go to the community center and want to resolve my dispute through mediation, I call up, I get an appointment, I pay nothing. If I'm so brazen that I want to go to court, I pay for the person who was smart enough to use mediation. through my filing fees.
Chair Miller,
I'm just saying, two-step process. If I just want to get this resolved through mediation, I call up a center, I get scheduled in, I pay nothing. But if I don't resolve my dispute or I don't choose to go that route and I go to court, I'm going to get next some filing fees to afford this opportunity for somebody else who chose mediation and I didn't.
Chair Miller, yes, that's correct. You'll be paying your filing fee not only to pay for the services of going through the court, but also there'll be the surcharge, which is a small part of the filing fee that then will go back to help fund these mediation services.
Right.
That's correct.
So the novel concept, I think, that Representative Doyle was talking about was actually charging the users a fee for the service. Incredible. Thank you. Boy, if that catches on.
But before we move, I think, to Monica's presentation, I wanted to give Jamie Damon, who is our committee chair,
please come forward,
a chance
Jamie.
To come up and say a few words and chime in on some of these questions that we've gotten.
I'm Jamie Damon. I'm the chair of the Dispute Resolution Commission. I live in Eagle Creek, Oregon, which is in Clackamas County, and thank you for having me here this morning. Chair Miller, it's interesting when you're talking about the novel approach of charging the fee for service. And, you know, philosophically, community programs have chosen not to charge because they didn't want to see a cost as an impediment for people to use what up until recently, I think, has been considered an alternative way to resolve, you know, the situation, something that people are not so familiar with. And, you know, any blocks that are in the way for people to understand how to go about doing, you know, mediation as opposed to going to court is just another reason for them to not want to work together. So philosophically, that's what folks have been, centers have done. But I think, as Susan had said, we're starting to think, well, you know, it's not so much alternative anymore, and more people are embracing this, and perhaps we need to look at another way, you know, to fund the programs that way. But to address what you were saying, Representative Doyle, about you know, where the programs get additional dollars, if you were to think about where people go in a community to resolve a dispute, you know, they're not necessarily going to go to the center direct. They're going to think about who can solve the problem for them. So they may go to, like, animal control and call them up. And so often what happens is the centers receive contracts with several other agencies where people generally go to get their dispute solved for them, so to speak. And so in a sense, they are, you know, they are paying for the service, you know, through their taxes, through getting the contracts through animal control or through, you know, a planning department or through code enforcement. Those kinds of agencies within a community often will have a contract with a program because they realize that it costs them as an agency a whole lot more to be dealing with situations than it will, you know, to when somebody calls them to say, well, go to the program. So that's, you know, that's kind of a backdoor way, I guess. So the user isn't really paying up front, but they're, you know, they're paying, you know, through contracts that way.
Representative Doyle?
And I thank you for that, because it makes sense that, you know, there is even those kind of contracts, you know, that the agencies say it's worth it to us because we're saving on the other end. My concern, even though there might be a couple of us sitting this panel today who probably won't be here in 2 years, a couple others that may, that if we're starting to deal now with the increasing cost of other programs and we're looking for areas that where the citizens are saying we're not going to pay extra taxes, we're not going to, you know, but we still want certain programs funded, then we're going to have to be looking at other, I guess, alternatives that include user fees like this. And those who are saying that they just want a free service, we do want it. But if there's a mechanism that can say, okay, you're not getting reimbursement from an agency, you're not going through the court system, basically you're coming in to resolve an issue that even if you hired lawyers, you'd be paying a little money on it. That, you know, there should be a mechanism to say that those people need to pay some kind of fee. And it even those who I would see something even working with the courts that say those who attempt to resolve the issue through the center you know, might then get some kind of break on a filing fee, so they're not having to double dip some way, you know, or they're not seeing that as an additional expense beyond. So it's not a penalty to go through mediation if they can't resolve it.
Well, what's ironic, Representative Doyle, is, you know, if, you know, the scenario that Chair Miller stated about, you know, somebody decides not to go to the center to resolve their dispute and they go right to court and they're, in a sense, subsidizing, you know, somebody else's opportunity to go to the community center. Well, in fact, what happens is the person who bypasses the community center in a small claims issue will show up at the court, file, and the judge will tell them to go to mediation anyway. So, I mean, they probably should have just gone to the center themselves, and that's what we're trying to do, is get them out earlier.
All right. Jamie, is there anything else you wanted to add?
Well, you know, Chair Miller looked through the information that Susan presented, and it...
You think she did all right?
I think she did wonderful. I didn't have any other, you know, other points. Last session, I sat in her chair because we didn't have a director, and, so I was glad for her to be making the presentation this time.
All right.
It seems like she really did present everything.
Sure. I appreciate your being here.
Just one question to Jamie. Are you proud of this program?
Oh, yes.
Why?
Well, you know, I've been a mediator since 1986, and I worked for over 7 years at the Community Mediation Program in Portland, and I served as the director there for a short amount of time. And I think that this program, it does so much to leverage so much more work to be done for the, you know, for the size of the staff and for the size of the budget. It isn't another layer. It's really, we're getting into programs both at the county and at the agency level, and helping people make connections in a way that they wouldn't be as efficient otherwise. And so, like for the public policy program, for example, I think there's a lot of people who know that things should be done a little bit differently, a little bit more cost effectively, getting together a little earlier, for example, and don't know quite how to go about doing that. And our program helps to make those alliances and bring those people together. So that we're not all doing it piecemeal, and the same way at the community level within the counties, you know, because there's, you know, I think a lot of people see the need to resolve differences in a more productive way, but don't necessarily know how to go about doing that, and we help to bring those folks together to make that happen.
On average, do people feel better about solving the problem through this process than they would through the court process?
Oh, yeah, because they retain so much more control over the outcome. And I think that's what people really want, is, you know, they feel out of control when they get angry and they don't know what to do or where to go. And to go to court or even to go to, you know, animal control, for example, they're giving up what they think would be the best outcome in the hopes that somebody else will decide what is fair, and often that's not the case. And in mediation, they retain that. They get to work with the person directly and have an outcome that's more what's really going to work for them. So it's a much more productive process, yeah.
What's the role of lawyers in this program? Are they participants in these?
Yeah, they... Representative or Chair Miller, it really depends. I mean, I have no legal background. When we met, I shared that, and I think I'm a bit of an anomaly in the field in that way. There are a lot of attorneys who are volunteers at the community centers. If parties retain attorneys, often the attorneys can participate in the mediation session as a resource. But the mediators try to get the folks to work directly with each other and not, you know, working through the attorneys. That's the whole point of the mediation. Do you have something you want to add to that?
No, I mean, I think there's a real combination of both attorneys and non-attorneys in this field, which is really nice. Mm-hmm. And at the community program level especially, you see a lot more just citizens who are not legally trained, who can participate in helping folks to resolve their disputes without that background, and they do a very effective job and are trained well. What I observe in the public policy dispute resolution arena is when you're dealing with multi-party complex public policy issues, attorneys are much more likely to be involved at that stage.
Mm-hmm. My question, and I appreciate what you supplied, was more in thinking about those who are participants as to whether or not they are represented by counsel, and as often as not, they are not.
Right, that's right.
Of course, if they're in divorce proceedings or if it's domestic relations, then, you know, they often are. as well.
Which would...
Those...
Think through this, and I'm glad you're examining the idea of perhaps some user fee, but it'd be my estimation that if somebody is able to obtain legal services, they could probably chip in a little bit for the mediation service and may not be discouraged.
Yeah, I would say, Chair Miller, from a community center perspective, you know, it is frustrating for a volunteer mediator who is putting in a lot of hours to sit at a table, you know, to give their time to work with two neighbors who have two paid attorneys sitting in the wings, you know, as a resource. I mean, it's an odd mix, and ideally what we'd like to see is the attorney's not there and the party's just coming in and sitting down or not even coming to the mediator at all and talking over their fence and resolving it that way. So, yeah, I agree. If they can afford to retain attorneys, they probably should be able to afford to pay for the mediator's time as well.
I would, Chair Miller, I'd like to add one other thing. We have been focusing on the provision of mediation services, but one of the really important things that our community programs do and that they're required to do in order to receive our grant funds is to provide citizen education within their community. And so part of what we're attempting to do is to build the skills of the average citizen to resolve disputes on their own without even needing to go to a mediator, much less an attorney. And that's a really important function, and it's a function that at the state level we help support by providing public information and education materials.
And through the training of mediators, the almost 1,000 volunteer mediators that you see in the report that Susan presented, those are folks who have been giving time to that program. That doesn't include all the folks who've been trained as mediators who just go back into their community and are working more effectively within their own family or within their own workplace, within their civic or community organizations. We don't count those hours. We hope that that's making a difference, but that is a role that the community programs can provide.
I certainly encourage you in that effort. Think back during the last, I don't know, it's probably been a couple decades when the advent of Judge Wampner, at least one of the first programs I can recall on TV, and I think their tagline to that program was, you know, don't do something foolish, take them to court. And it was just like we've got to have some formal proceeding that precludes us from talking, as you suggest, to your neighbor and resolving your dispute in a pretty one-on-one, more cordial way. It's a huge societal problem in my view, but anyway, I encourage you. So, we're back to, is Monica, is this your moment?
I guess so.
Okay. Glad to have your report, and thank you both very much for your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, for the record, Monica Brown, the Department of Administrative Services. I'm going to be walking you through this handout. For the most part, I think Ms. Mon and Ms. Brody have covered most of the information, so I'll try to get through it really quickly. The governor's budget is just over $2 million for the commission and covers 5 positions and 4 full-time equivalent positions. Largely other funds supported again by the surcharge, with a small amount in general fund that supports just one position within the commission. The budget is a 21% decrease from the 9901 legislatively approved. Largely that decrease is represented by substantial one-time grants and funds that were in 9901. So most current services are maintained. And it does reduce payments for new dispute resolution centers. That's because a good deal of the unserved counties have come on board, so the balance available for new centers has been declining. So we're bringing the expenditure limitation in line with the resources that are available for startup funds. We are also phasing out the distribution of grants to community dispute resolution centers for the Manufactured Dwelling Park Mediation Program. That program will continue within Housing and Community Services Agency. This commission will continue to work with Housing and Community Services, but Housing will distribute the payments from this point forward rather than funneling through the commission. So you're going to see that reduction. By category, special payments makes up the largest part, about 61%. Again, those are the grants to the community dispute resolution centers. In arriving at the governor's recommended budget, as you're well aware, we first adjust for any emergency board actions that occurred through April of 2000, which included employee compensation cost increases, as well as a lot of those one-time grants that we mentioned. Then the current service level is adjusted for position and inflationary costs anticipated for 2001-03. One-time monies that were approved this biennium are phased out for 01-03. And there is one policy package to account for two minor position adjustments within the commission, and the commission is funding those through reducing services and supplies budget to finance those adjustments. With that, Mr. Chair, I'll give it back over to you for questions.
All right. Are there questions? Thank you. All right. Robin?
Mr. Chair, members, I believe that we are ready to move into the discussion of the public policy dispute resolution program.
All right. We have Ms. Brody's back. Mr. Arnold is here. Mr. Wolf from the governor's office.
Start without him.
Yeah, that's right.
second here to organize materials. Chair Miller and members of the committee, I'd now like to open a presentation on the Public Policy Dispute Resolution Program, or another name for it is Alternative Dispute Resolution in State Government. I've provided some handouts, I think, that are just coming around to your places now that you can follow along with. The Dispute Resolution Commission plays a key role in this program, but as I mentioned before, we're not the sole player. I really think it was very wise how the legislature structured this program, which was to have the Dispute Resolution Commission involved, but also have the Department of Justice, the Department of Administrative Services, and the Governor's Office as key players. Because to be effective in promoting the use of alternative dispute resolution in state government and working with state agencies, I've really found from my experience over this first couple of years that I've been in the job that having that network, having that not only us, but the Department of Justice and Department of Administrative Services playing a key role, helps us get the message across to state agencies in a way that our agency acting alone could not. We have a steering committee. The statute requires the four entities to work together, DAS, ODRC, DOJ, and the Governor's Office. In order to manage the program, the governor passed an executive order creating a steering committee. And Greg Wolf from the governor's office chairs that steering committee. So we were going to begin the presentation by, and Don Arnold is a member of that steering committee representing Department of Justice. So we were going to begin the presentation today with Greg and Don sharing their perspective on the organization of the program, and then I'll come back in and talk some more about the details.
All right.
Chair Miller, members of the committee, my name for the record is Don Arnold. I'm administrator of the General Counsel Division, Department of Justice. As you may recall, when I was before this committee on the Department of Justice budget, I spoke briefly about some of the things that Department of Justice was doing in the area of ADR. As Susan has said, ADR really is it's a bigger issue than any one agency. There are several that have significant roles to play with regard to ADR. And in the past, both before the current statute was amended to provide for more coordination of ADR programs in state government, and before the governor adopted his executive order creating the steering committee, ADR in state government really was pretty fragmented, and we saw competition to some extent, and certainly lack of coordination among the agencies that had a role to play with regard to ADR. With the advent of the changes in ORS 183-502, which is a statute that deals with ADR in state government, and by the way, that statute is replete with references to direction to both Department of Justice and Department of Administrative Services and the Dispute Resolution Commission to cooperate or to coordinate on a variety of issues related to ADR. But with the advent of the steering committee, I think what we have seen is much greater coordination among the agencies that have a principal role in ADR and state government. Now, how effective has that steering committee been? I'll only speak for the Department of Justice, and perhaps Craig can speak from a broader perspective. But certainly from the Department of Justice's perspective, the steering committee and the coordination that it has brought has been a very positive development. And there are three principal reasons that I think this is so. First, it has allowed the Department of Justice and Department of Administrative Services and the Commission to coordinate and to consolidate, to pool the limited resources that they have available to each of those agencies individually, to coordinate their use, to avoid overlapping programs, and generally to make more efficient use of what's available. Second, and related to the efficiency that I think is achieved by pooling those resources, it provides a forum or a mechanism for statewide planning on ADR policy and program issues. And I think that also has been a major step toward making more efficient use of those resources. And finally, it assures that that there is cooperation rather than competition among the agencies that are involved in these programs. And as I alluded to earlier, I think that is a very positive development for the state. If you take a look at what's happening in other states, Oregon is somewhat unique in this respect. I don't know of any other state that has a system in place that allows for the statewide coordination on this issue that you find in Oregon. I think that is really a very positive development.
Thank you, Mr. Arnold. Mr. Wolf?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Greg, for the record, Greg Wolf, Governor's Office. I think the legislative, I guess I would just share Don's view on the program. The legislative construction for this, I think, is very good. In order to have an effective program in state government in this field, you really need to have the expertise that the Oregon Dispute Resolution Commission brings, the legal support of the Attorney General in doing this work, and the management assistance of the Department of Administrative Services and the cluster agencies that are helping us carry it out within state government. And then I think the support and the coordination that comes from the governor's office is also important for state government to have present in that system, because I think it sends the signal and the message that this is viewed as something that's important to the state. A study was done several years ago that looked at dispute resolution programs around the country, and this is done about, I guess, 7-8 years ago, and it found that a lot of the programs that existed were either in a particular state agency, in the Attorney General's office, in the governor's office, in universities, and they were in these different places. And there really wasn't any consistency around the country about where they were located. But what the study found was that wherever they were, if they were isolated from where the action was, really in the state agencies, they were not effective because the disputes weren't making it to the place where the resources were available to solve those problems. And that's really the reason that this program, I think some of the early reason that this program is designed in the way it was. And now around the country, this model is being looked at and copied in other states as a model, because it does integrate the different parts of state government in carrying it out, and has had quite a bit of success. And I'm sure Susan has talked about the cases that have been resolved through the program. One of our goals is to reduce litigation, reduce costs in state government of conflict resolution. And what we've found is that if we have a system that allows us to put cases into just negotiation, between the parties without a mediator where that's appropriate, or into litigation where that's appropriate, or into mediation where that's appropriate, we save a lot of money. Because if you put a case into one of those three categories that doesn't belong there or can't really be solved there, you spend a lot of time and money just going through the process and not coming out with a lasting solution. We're doing a lot of work now to try to track the cost savings associated with this, and we're in the early. Since the program is so young, we don't have enough database there to really make conclusive kinds of assumptions about that. But we do have some preliminary indication that this really has been a cost-effective part of state government, and certainly, our own experience has been that. Cases are much more satisfactorily dealt with through this program when that's the appropriate place to put them, because as Susan mentioned with respect to the community program, it's really true here too that people involved in these cases, whether in the private sector or the public sector or nonprofit sector, when they have more control over the outcome through the direct negotiation, the result is much more satisfactory to them, and they have a better sense of control in the outcome, which they have. And so it's been, I guess from our perspective, it's been a very, very successful program in that way. The other thing I guess I'd mention is that the whole system is sort of geared towards litigation today. Whenever you're dealing with public policy disputes, it's very easy for a state agency to turn to their attorney and say, well, we can't reach agreement on this, or the such and such problem can't be resolved. So we'll just put it into litigation, and there's a budget for that, and it's just a very convenient thing to do. And so what we're trying to do here is offer an alternative to that, and it has, I think, it's difficult to get that kind of change within the system. I mean, and that's part of, I think, what has been successful about this program is having all these different parts of state government working together is really what you need in order to make that kind of a change and to make that kind of alternative available to state agencies to use.
Senator Trout?
I'm just wondering, the two processes, it as compared to contested case hearings, what sort of experience could you say about the two?
Well, I think I would say that it depends on what the case is, where you want to put the case. If it's a sometimes contested case is the only way to go because the issues are too clear and the disagreement is so sharp that that's the only place you can go for a resolution. In other cases, mediation is very well used. One of the things this program did in the water resources area was build into the contested case process and a moment when you could go to mediation if you felt that would work. And I think, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but a vast number of those contested cases ended up in mediation rather than go all the way through the contested case process because the parties involved believed that would be a better way to resolve the dispute. So that's an example of a system design change that has worked well.
And if I might, another example of building in that kind of option into a system is with the Land Use Board of Appeals with land use cases. So now in the LUBA statute, there's a way for cases to be stayed where they go out for mediation and then come back in, and so that's routinely can be used now easily by parties. Let me continue and just walk you through a few of the additional pages in the handout. Page 3 is to give you an overview of how the structure works. So the steering committee that Don and Greg have talked about is there at the top and provides for management and accountability in the system. We have positions that are called, we have coordinating agencies. They're actually in the statute, in ORS 183-502, it talks about the program working with coordinating agencies, and the steering committee has designated those coordinating agencies, and each of those four coordinating agencies, which is the case right now, have hired a staff person that provides services to clusters of agencies served by that coordinating agency. So this diagram shows you how that works and what are the references in statute to why it is organized that way. In addition, the governor recently adopted an executive order requiring agencies that have more than 50 FTEs, so the larger state agencies, to appoint an ADR contact within those agencies. And for those agencies that have over 50 FTE, for them to prepare something called a needs assessment, an ADR needs assessment, so that we can get a more systematic look across state of where the opportunities are for use of alternative dispute resolution on a more systems basis. And so that's an additional component to the structure now, to the network that we have, that we're very excited about because we think it'll allow us to advance the program further than we have been able to do in the past. Just a little bit of history, some of you already know this, the public policy dispute resolution program in the beginning, 11 years ago, was started with the natural resources agencies, and it remained that way until 1997, when the 1997 Legislative Assembly allowed us, provided more funding to allow expansion of the program. So now that it attempts to serve all areas of state government. But expanding to those other areas of state government is still relatively new. So there's still a lot of work to be done in those areas. It's fairly well established in the natural resources area, but in human services, the general government agencies, and in transportation and community development, we've really just for a couple of years been staffed up to be able to start working in that area. We put together a page 4, that talks about some of the benefits and cost savings that accrue through use of alternative dispute resolution in state government. And we've attached as page 5 a graph out of a report that was recently completed by the Department of Justice and looked at the trial court division, the trial division within the Department of Justice, and gathered data on the average process costs of different routes that disputes take, all the way from going to trial where there's a verdict to settlement negotiations, but also including mediation. And this isn't this is a beginning point or one window on the cost question. There are lots of other dimensions to the cost question that can be looked at and need to be examined, but this gives you one piece of data to look at, which I think is helpful and a good beginning. If you turn to page 6, you'll see that the statute gives us 3 primary goals or outcomes that are to be achieved. One is to increase agency efficiency, second is to decrease the cost of resolving disputes, and then to increase public and agency satisfaction. And this business about developing dispute resolution systems within state government really speaks to the agency efficiency question, because if you can have whole classes of cases which are handled in the most effective way possible in terms of resolving their disputes, you're going to save time and money of state agency staff and agencies. There's a high level of satisfaction for the parties to these disputes, and we've gathered data on that and have reported that in our biennial report to the legislature. And we are still working on gathering good cost data. We've made some starts. As I mentioned in my earlier presentation, we contracted with an economist and program evaluation consultant this biennium to help respond to the charge that you gave us to develop mechanisms for measuring cost savings, and we're starting to pilot some of the instruments and forms that he has developed for us. This is the report that we did, that we're required to do. Department of Justice, DAS, and ODRC are required to report to you as the legislature every 2 years on the programs. And you've all received the executive summaries, but I wanted to put this in front of you. Maybe you need one more, Father, I'm sorry. Because I wanted to come back to the accountability question that Robin had mentioned. This reporting that we do to the legislature every 2 years is our way of being accountable as a program, a coordinated program to the legislature in reporting on the kinds of the work that we do, the results that we've achieved, and so forth. And we're very proud of what we've been able to do this biennium as opposed to, you know, what we've been able to do in past biennia in terms of reporting. And I want to call your attention to a couple of things which I think are very impressive. If you turn to page 23, which is in the appendix of this report, you will see descriptions of over 22 ADR programs that exist within state agencies. That is where they have an alternative dispute resolution mechanism or program in place to help deal with some of the conflicts and disputes. This is really, I think, quite remarkable, and there's a lot more that needs to be done, but we think we're on the right track, and through continued work in this program, we should be able to have more and more of these kind of programs operating. I also, if you turn to page 12 of the report, actually, I'm sorry, page 16, gives information on case results and satisfaction with the outcome and the process that was used. And I'd be happy to answer any questions you have about this information and data, but we think that we've provided a good overview here of the program successes, the challenges, and what we know about satisfaction with the program.
One question I had, Susan, on that last point in here, but it is stated that there's a high level of successful outcomes, excluding cases still in progress or which the outcome was unknown. 90% of the cases that used a collaborative process ended in a full or partial agreement. Can you break down how many are full and how many are partial?
I think I can, but I can't do it right now, but I could bring that back to you.
Okay. Thank you.
I think that maybe what's left to cover is just to circle back to the ODRC part of this, which is that we have had a general fund component as part of our budget, which gives us the capacity to participate in the public policy dispute resolution program. That proposed for the 2001 to 2003 biennium and as an amount, approximately $120,000 of general fund, which would continue that staff support in ODRC for this program. That is actually a decrease from the previous biennium, from this biennium. In addition, and Robin, I think I should speak to this as well, as you saw in that in the chart, a certain amount of money, 20% of the surcharge on court filing fees, flows through Department of Administrative Services and is distributed out to help fund the salaries of cluster coordinator positions in these four coordinating agencies, and also provides us with some limited funding for grants and special projects to help support the program. That money is in the DAS budget. It's shown as a transfer out in our budget to DAS, the $422,000. In the DAS budget request that was in front of the General Government Subcommittee, there was a request to increase, to supplement that amount with general funds. And they did not approve that, and they directed this committee just to consider the program as a whole, but I just wanted to point that out. And The question, one of the questions Robin has asked us to address is what would happen if we didn't have this additional funding? Well, the program would still continue to operate, but probably at a slightly lower level of service than we're able to provide right now because costs increase a little bit higher rate than the increase that we see from the surcharge on court filing fees. The steering committee might have to be faced with looking at decreasing the number of cluster coordinator positions from 4 to 3. It looks like we would not have as much money available to us for grants and special projects. So the reason that the request was made in the DAS budget was to allow us to continue to make the progress that we have into the future in the next biennium, and we had reservations that we would be able to sustain the same level of effort or make further progress without some additional funds. So that's why the request was made. If the money isn't forthcoming, we will still continue to provide good service in this program, but we won't be able to make as much progress as we would have otherwise.
Mr. Chair, members, the reality is that the General Government Subcommittee did not approve that general fund package, so the general fund support in DAS is no longer there, and the General Government Subcommittee also referred discussion on the impact of that issue to this committee.
Great.
So that's partially why you're having the discussion here today.
Maybe we can get somebody to mediate between us.
General government, there you go.
I think okay. That concludes our presentation.
Well, thank you. Representative Doyle, a question?
Sure, thank you. Looking on page 16 of the, report?
Report.
The biennial report. Just right at the top, the case results. The last sentence of that paragraph discusses mediators from the private sector being hired to provide assistance in 55 of the cases. Do the agencies pay those mediators?
Yes, they do. Often the parties may also participate. So when you bring the party, and let me just step back from that for a minute, Representative Doyle, because I think that's just a unique and really very important feature of our program, that we are not actually providing the mediation staff out of state government employees, but we're partnering with the private sector to provide those services. When a mediator is hired, and let's say you have 5 parties around the table, it is often the case that those 5 parties will be encouraged to share the costs of the mediator services. We have had a small amount of grant money available to us that can sometimes be used to help pay for some of those costs, but it's usually in partnership with other parties also paying some of those costs. And sometimes our ability to give a state agency a little bit of money to help defer the costs of hiring a mediator makes the difference as to whether that agency feels comfortable in going ahead and retaining the services of a mediator.
And would those mediators, I guess, always trying to discern private sector, would they always be coming out of private sector? Would they be state employees, for example, who have maybe a separate mediation service? I don't even know if they do on the side that they could do this work, or is it would it be people connected with the commission that would end up getting paid for this kind of work?
Almost exclusively, these are private sector mediators who do not have that connection to state government. There has been some work that the Department of Justice has done in the last year to try to put together a list of state employees who have mediation skills that might be used in some limited circumstances for free.
Okay.
That could be one agency. They might work for an agency over here. An agency over here might be able to use their services for certain kinds of mediations or facilitations, but that would not be a charge for service.
Chair Miller, Representative Doyle, one other reason that we think that's a good feature of this program is that oftentimes private sector parties to cases are not comfortable with a state mediator in that role, because the state oftentimes has a real interest in some of these cases. So we think it works much better from a standpoint of neutrality to bring in somebody from the outside that can serve as that mediator.
If the case is between just exclusively private parties interpreting statute or ordinance, would there ever be a situation where the private parties received advice or came in through the mediation service and said, gosh, it'd sure be great if you guys would hire a mediator, a private mediator, and pay for it, and we'll continue to argue our dispute, and you can pick up all the costs, and gosh, that's great.
Doesn't really, for our program to be involved in this, the state, a state agency needs to indicate, either be a party, or there needs to be like an overriding state interest. So for example, in the land use arena, cases could be mediated coming out of LUBA, of course that's a state agency, but the parties who might be mediating, there might not be a state agency at the table there. But in the land use arena, of course, since we have the statewide land use program, there are critical state issues that are at stake there. But it's almost predominantly what you'll find in these cases are that the state, a state agency is a party, is one of the parties or has a significant interest.
All right. Well, I thank you. And Representative Doyle?
Yeah, just one more follow-up, I guess, on using private sector mediators. Do you have a sense of how many individual mediators either that are on the panel that's offered to these parties or that are actually being used? I mean, I guess my concern is that we're throwing all the work maybe to a few people as opposed to, you know, having it to a number of different individuals.
Well, Department of Justice helps maintain this roster of state mediators, which has over 200 names on it right now.
Chair Miller, Representative Doyle, we periodically solicit additional names, additional mediators, to place their names on this list. We have pretty minimal requirements for getting your name on the list. And as Susan said, we currently have over 200 mediators. The list, what the list does is take those mediators, take their resumes, enter the information about their background, their experience into a database, so that if an agency is looking for a mediator, for example, with land use experience, they can go into this database, which is accessible to all agencies directly, call up a list of mediators that meet the criteria that they're looking for, and then select who they think is most appropriate. So, no, this, to directly answer your question, it's not a limited number. There are lots of mediators on the list, and it's very easy for a mediator to get onto the list.
The mediators might be, there are a set of mediators on the list, Representative Doyle, who might have workplace mediation experience, and they would be drawn on for that. Another set of folks who have special skills in doing complex multi-party public cases. That's a much smaller number than the 200 who would be drawn on for that purpose.
Thank you. Further questions? Representative Leonard, any more questions from you?
Well, they answered that last. I appreciate that answer, full and complete as it was. Thank you.
Thank you. If there's
no further just not getting
questions
away with anything
from the
members,
we thank you again for your presentation here today.
Mr. Chair, well, I'll just mention what you and I just discussed, which is that we will go to work session tomorrow, and it will start at 9:30. The chair has another appointment, so.
You can't commit yourself to the entire 2 hours of the session tomorrow.
Well, we're hoping that it doesn't take an entire
2 hours
now. I'm certainly amenable to the fact we could schedule it perhaps earlier if you two wanted to come
No, that's fine, Mr. Chair.
And carry on without the chair.
I don't want to challenge you.
And I will distribute.
So, have you got word on that? 9:30 tomorrow instead of 8:30. If there's nothing further to come before the committee, we are adjourned.